I'm so excited to share with you that the doors are officially open for my first ever phone-free event that's happening in Los Angeles, California on February 28th at Mudwater Gather in Santa Monica, with the option for you to dive even deeper on March 1st. Now look, this event is about you. It's about you building connections and community and us all really bringing this analog revolution to life and reminding our hearts and souls what we truly crave most, what nourishes our being, which is co-regulating with other humans, having our mirror neurons dance together, sharing experiences together, but also learning together. So on top of all the community and connection possibilities for you, there's also an incredible lineup of speakers. I've got internationally renowned nervous system expert Sarah Baldwin, Nike master trainer Brandon Collingsworth talking about purpose and meaning, and Mandy Balak, who's the president of the Gathering Festival, which is one of the largest marketing and branding conferences in North America. So we're going to be diving deeper into what does the future look like to walk alongside technology and use technology as a tool. Now look, if you want to dive even deeper, there's limited space for a VIP dinner on the Saturday night. And if you want to go even deeper, if it's aligned for leaders, coaches, therapists, entrepreneurs, branding, marketing, whoever is called, there's a mastermind on the Sunday morning with even more limited seating. And that's going to be about what does the future look like to create in this world with technology. So if this sounds like something you're interested in, you want to find out more and save your spot, go to markgroves.com/future. I can't wait to see you there.
I use the term cancel culture if it's specific in the context, but it's why I created the term collective sabotage, because it doesn't have that same charge and it doesn't take a side. And I think it's actually more accurate to describe what is happening around us when our behavior is in direct conflict with what we say it is we want, you know? And I think it's because of self-sabotage. It's each individual in their mode of self-sabotage. And then we come together as a collective and it becomes what we see as cancel culture. To me, that's collective sabotage. So I'm very intentional with my language. And this might be useful for anyone listening to this to just think, where are you finding yourself using, even without even realizing, especially without realizing, dehumanizing language that feeds into the very division that you probably want to push back against?
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Mark Groves Podcast. Today, I have writer, consultant, developmental coach, but I want to say so much more, although that's a lot, but I'm like, my experience of this woman is that she is a profound thought leader. She is a mentor. She is a philosopher. She is really exploring the complexities of the human experience, especially when it comes to communication and taking up space in the world as our full authentic selves. Without further ado, Avika Brooke, welcome.
Thank you. I have a very big smile on my face because I've been looking forward to this conversation for a while. And just before we started recording, we were chatting for a little while. And it's kind of blowing my mind to know that we last spoke 2.5, nearly 3 years ago. So I'm very excited because it feels like so much has changed. But when it comes to the mission that you and I have in terms of just exploring the truth, regardless of how uncomfortable it is, I feel like we are still going just as hard for it, you know, even though so much time has passed. So I'm so excited. Thank you for having me, Mark.
So much life has occurred since the last time we spoke, and so much cultural stuff has occurred. You know, September 2021, I mean, I think of like that being the height of the experience of collective trauma, of super heightened fear. You have cancel culture, you have all these big cultural moments as movements. Yeah. And for you listening or watching, Avika is just released a new book called The Third Perspective, Brave Expression in the Age of Intolerance. And I'm going to speak for most people just because I'm the one with the microphone right now. And I think it's a fair observation, which is that we live in a time when to in any way verbalize or express something that rocks the boat or challenges an ideology that we've just said, this is just the way it is. And if you don't agree with this, then you are, you know, it's like we get trapped in these binaries, like you're either for it or you're against it. And I've made the argument a lot
recently of like the criticism of something is not always the rejection of it. And so like your book is so necessary. Everybody go get this book. Like it, there's, we all need a third perspective. So I'm curious, because this book obviously has been inspired through so many of your own life moments. 10 years ago, 5 years ago, like when would you have envisioned that this book might be written, and like, or were you in an opposite end of a spectrum?
First of all, thank you so much for that reflection. And I, you know what, as I think about even just the idea of the third perspective, so that title, to me, it's really not just a title or a nice to have or some kind of philosophical context. Exactly as you said, we are so trapped in binary thinking right now. And I think it's quite frightening. I think we don't realize just how much it's dismantling the idea of collective intimacy and relational collaboration. And I just think we have a bigger problem on our hands than we realize. And I think a lot of it is because of how we are so fixated with the idea of only there only being two options, you know, that you're either left or you're right. You're with us or you're against us. You're pro or you're anti. You are, you know, there's just so many false ideas and boxes that people have to force themselves into. And we're seeing the impact of that. So for me, the third perspective, I think of it as an invitation out of that binary, a realization that there are more options available to us than we are made to believe there are. And I think I would never have thought that I would write this book, actually, because I would have been too terrified to write this kind of book. I would have been too terrified to write a book that says we have gone to such an extreme and we need to reject it. I would have been afraid to say that, actually, as a Black woman, I don't see things in the way that I'm told that I need to because of my race. I would have been so afraid to say that as a left-leaning person, I reject a lot of things that I'm seeing from the so-called left. I would have been terrified to say any of those things.
Yeah, me too.
And they're not, right? And they're not everything that I'm saying, but there are parts of my story that I have been told should either be silenced or just kept in my mind, or they're not to be externalized, you know? So I started writing this and wanting to explore the subject of brave expression in the age of intolerance in 2020. But I would say everything started before then. I was on the internet from 2016 in terms of me sharing my story and building the platform that I have today. And that was because I needed to get sober. I was struggling very, very much with alcohol. And it wasn't just alcohol, but there were so many other drugs that came with it. I'm so grateful that I never had the urge to try harder drugs like heroin or crack or anything like that. I always had resistance to anything that was harder than your typical party drugs. But from when I was 14 years old up until I was 24, I had a very big problem with drugs and drinking. And, you know, I've shared my story so many times, but each time I share it, even those specific years of my life, I always get full body chills because I'm taken back to exactly what it felt like to be in that level of darkness at such a young age. And now as a 31-year-old woman, I realized just how young I was. I realized that I was a 14-year-old girl, 18-year-old, 19, 20, and just living so dangerously. And in that timeline, I relapsed 7 times. I really did try my very, very best to get sober once I realized just how bad my drinking was, because I would black out pretty much every single time that I drank. And I'm not just saying that in a hyperbolic way. That's exactly how it was for me. From 14 years old, I drank so quickly and so much that I trained myself to drink in a very specific way. And that carried on for a decade. But I really did assume that everyone blacked out. That was my assumption until I started to share with other people and realized that actually it happens to a small amount of people, not as many as I thought. But that part of my story is very important because it's really where I got to see my own contradictions. When I wasn't drinking and I was sober, I was pretty quiet, kind of reserved, not shy in any way, but just quiet, a little bit more reserved. And I could be reliable. I could be there for other people. I didn't lie. I was quite uncomfortable with lying. But when I was drunk, when I would sort of turn into this other version of myself, there would be this, almost like all of those parts that I was repressing, all of those parts that I was told were bad, that I shouldn't be angry, that I shouldn't be sexual, that I shouldn't be playful, that I shouldn't be X, Y, Z, insert whatever thing is. All of those parts of me could actually finally express themselves when I was drunk, when I was fucked up. And I really got to witness just the duality of me, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that was such an important thing. And I can only really honor it now in retrospect, having been sober for nearly 9 years, because I think it's why I've always been quite comfortable in understanding other people's shadow as well, because I got to see my own at such a young age. And even before that, my father was an alcoholic as well. And I remember, this was back in Zimbabwe where I'm born, where I was born and raised. I remember him coming home and me and my siblings and my mom never knowing what mood he was going to be in, because if he was drunk, he would be all of those shadowy things, even though sometimes that shadow included him being so excited and giving us his work papers to draw on or whatever it might be. He's just in a fantastic mood. Or sometimes the shadow would be him being so angry because maybe he's gambled and he's lost all of his money, or whatever resentment he had towards my mother was coming to the surface. We just never knew what version of my dad we were going to get. So when I sort of play my story back even more, I realized that actually I got to see my own contradictions in my addiction. But even before that, I got to see them through my father. And yet I loved him, but I hated him just as much. And all of these pieces of my story are so important in shaping the person that I am now, because my work decades on has led me to a place of wanting to, or rather encouraging people to embrace their own contradictions without excusing anything. Embrace your own contradictions, because it's going to help you understand people with opposing worldviews. It's going to help you understand the people you disagree with. It's going to help you know how to navigate other people's shadows online and offline. So when I look at this book, I couldn't have pictured it. It was never the plan to write some kind of profound book or guide for other people. It was just a realization about 4 years ago that there's something that we're experiencing collectively. There is an issue with us rejecting our shadows, but then our shadows are coming out to play online, which is where we spend most of our time now. So that's kind of like a little bullet point version, if you will, of why I'm writing The Third Perspective and why I think this message is very, very important now more than ever.
That's so interesting to think, like our inability to be with our own contradictions, our own, you know, I think about the concept that gets presented that if any of us lived at the time of Nazi Germany and we were, let's say, a German man in our 20s or 30s at that time, under the same cultural societal experience, we would all become what they became. Like this idea that really challenges that, oh, well, if I was back then, I would have hit Anne Frank. I would have, like, we all have these sort of idolized, it's even the way we, you know, that meme that says, we're all the daughters of the witches they didn't burn.
Yes. And yes. Yes.
I remember hearing this person, I forget who it was, but they said, that's such a romantic idea, but you also were likely related to the people who burned the witches. I think when humans, and I think this about, I'm curious your thoughts on this and how this plays out, because when I think of like the shadow side of the right, for example, what we call the right, and again, I'm just using this for the sake of understanding the archetypes that we're speaking to, of how we organize these perspectives and identify them as systems. But it's like the shadow side of the right's pretty obvious. It's very explicit, you know, it's racism, it's bigotry, it's et cetera. But it's like the shadow side of the left, I actually find really fascinating psychologically, because it masquerades as altruism. It's this perspective that I can never be captured by bad. And I actually think it is the very belief that you could never be captured by an ideology that is the access point to being captured by an ideology. Like it's a strange irony, but I say that because it comes back to this idea, like if you don't believe you're capable of dehumanization and being a bad person, which everybody is, then it will come out in these ways. And it's so interesting that we've made it culturally okay or socially acceptable that it can come out in ways that are masquerading as being in the promotion of things like diversity, right? But in your book, and I love how you open the book because you say, what about diversity of thought?
Right.
And I never really thought about, like, there's this desire for a homogeny of perspective, and anything that's not that then is seen as bad or right. Or, and again, there are obviously bad ideas, but when diversity makes every system better. So when diversity of thought is not allowed to exist, really bad ideas proliferate. So I'm curious what you think about what I said. Yeah.
I love that, because I was one of those people, I would say about 6 years ago, that rejected the idea of diversity of thought because I thought it was just like I associated it with right wing. And I'm not even in North America, right? Same. I'm in the UK, I'm in London. But here it's the very same thing, this false binary and false idea that people fit neatly into the Labour Party, which is left, or the Conservative Party, which is on the right. And now when I think of the fact that I truly associated the idea of diversity of thought with the right, even for a short time, the idea that freedom of speech is a right-wing yearning, when actually, if you were to look at its origins, it's a very progressive idea and value. But it's almost like everything has been warped to the point where you reject its importance, even though you know that it means something. So the idea that I had and what it's quite mad, isn't it? The idea that I had around diversity of thought was that, well, the diversity that you need is racial diversity. And then, you know, sexual or gender diversity. And then that sorts out the issue of diversity, full stop. Why do you need the so-called right. diversity of thought? It was just this idea that diversity stops at race, gender, and sex. I truly believed it, and I never really questioned it. And I wouldn't even say that I created this thing in my own head that diversity of thought is a right-wing desire. But again, I was just taking what I'd heard, because there's this idea that if another left-leaning person says it, you're just supposed to trust it. If another left-leaning person says this person is problematic or dangerous, I'm just supposed to believe it. If this is so on, right? So there was never any critical thinking on my part, or at least there wasn't critical thinking in the places where it mattered the most. But then when I really started to question this idea, I realized that essentially what I'm saying is, if you have a group of Black people, they all, how would I even word this? Because it feels so complicated in my head, but I think essentially what I was doing is dehumanizing myself. This idea that me being Black and me being a woman is enough diversity. I don't get to think differently. I couldn't be a Black woman who's left-leaning, but somewhat agrees with some things that are on the so-called right, that if I'm all of these things, then I have to just accept that this is the kind of diversity that is approved and is enough. And if this sounds complex and confusing, that's because it fucking is. Because when you really think about it, none of it makes any sense. But I remember just associating so many things to the right without question, even freedom of speech. And when you really think about what that means, right? Even the idea of freedom, just the word freedom now is associated with the right.
It actually requires, this is actually the mental gymnastics that are required to actually practice this. This is actually why I think so many people have anxiety now, is because you actually have to begin or continue to agree to things that aren't real. Like I think of the scientific experiments where there's three lines being presented, and there's a line on the left and three lines on the right. And there's, let's say, 10 observers. 9 of them are actors. The actors are told to give the wrong answer. So they give the right answer. They do three sets of it. So like first one, second one. And they say like, which line on the right matches the length of the line mm-hmm. on the left? And what happens is so the actors are told to give the right answer for the first three. And then on the fourth one, they give the wrong answer, and they get to the test subject, and they see how often are they willing to deny what they see in order to maintain assimilation with the group. Mm-hmm. And the percentage is really high. It's like, I think 37%. But what's interesting, if they add one other person earlier in the process, it actually gives the test subject, like someone earlier gives the right answer, the test subject is more likely to now actually join with the person who took the risk first.
Right.
It's really fascinating, because what you're saying about this idea that if you are these things, right, then this is the agreed upon perspectives you're allowed to mm-hmm. hold to maintain mm-hmm. membership into Black Woman, right? Like whatever yes. that construct is.
Yes.
And that's interesting, because now you're in this box that's like, oh, I can't. And it, you know, maybe like 4 months ago, I put up this post. I forget what I was talking about, but someone said, that's an interesting perspective for a cis white male. The thing I was talking about literally had nothing to do with my race or my gender identity mm-hmm. or anything. And I remember just thinking like, I sent it to my buddy who's Black, and I was saying, because I always like to reflect, like, am I totally off? Am I like taking this the wrong way? Like, am I? And he was like, wow, you've been reduced to that. Like, you're not allowed to have any thoughts.
Right.
You, especially as a privileged white male, your perspective is now allowed to sit in here. And, you know, I was having a conversation about gender recently with someone, and they mm-hmm. said, well, you know, as two cis white, this was a woman, how are we to have a perspective on that? I'm like, well, we are born a biological sex. We have a gender expression.
Yeah.
Pretty qualified, actually. Like, I don't suffer from gender dysphoria, but like, I think we can still talk about it without it being
yes.
like all of a sudden our opinion doesn't matter. And that seemed to play out a lot. Like, your experience of Black Lives Matter was obviously different than my experience as a white
mm-hmm.
guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I found the movement to be so important. I understood the
Absolutely.
Motivation of it. Right. And I found myself fawning in a way, like wanting to not get anything wrong, not say the wrong thing. I saw this like aggressive, like if you didn't post a Black square one day, but mm-hmm. then if you did, you were pro. And then if you weren't, and if you did it, if you didn't do it, you were racist. If you did do it, actually, now there's a mind fuck. You actually are even more racist because you're now. And I was just like, there was so much trepidation about everything, but
yeah.
what was fascinating is I started to then see how this, like, because I want to hear, I know we've talked offline about this, but I would really love mm-hmm. to hear how you weaved through this, because that I'm starting to question narratives and how I don't fit in,
yes.
you were saying 2019, 2020.
Yes.
For me, I'm like not even thinking about that. I'm just like, okay, how do I participate in this cultural conversation and actually
yeah.
educate myself? And then COVID comes along and like protests aren't allowed. And like the Canadian convoy, trucker convoy, is called racist,
right.
even though a lot of the truckers are actually Sikh and like people of color. And I knew lots of people of color who participated in it till all of a sudden it was called racist, which of course is a brilliant strategy by a government to slow an uprising. But then all of a sudden I see Black Lives Matter protests and there's no concern about COVID. They're not super spreader events and you're not allowed to talk about it. And I'm like, you have to shut your brain off to actually so like, how did you see all those things weaving together? And correct me if I said anything stupid, not reflective, you know, ignorant, right? It's like, I'm always open to that feedback.
Yeah. And to me, the reason I'm so grateful for this conversation is because there was a time where probably both you and I would never have even dared to talk in this way publicly, knowing that thousands of people could listen to a conversation like this, right? Which is why I really I'm so fascinated with the idea of self-censorship, which is essentially what we're exploring here and a big part of my work and what it is that I do. When you begin to withhold your own ideas and your own opinions and withhold questions, even questions to yourself to say, hey, do I actually believe in this? Not even externalized, just in your own mind. You begin to self-edit. There's like a surveillance team inside your mind. To me, that's a very, very, very big problem. So a big part of my work now and the conversation that we're having was inspired by that timeline from 2019 to 2020. I had been, because of my sobriety work, I'd been labeled an advocate for quite some time, a recovery advocate from 2016 onwards. And I was pretty happy with that, actually, because it felt like my work was actually being taken seriously. I'd never intended to start a platform or an online community or to have the reputation that I do as a speaker or anything. I just started writing because I needed to get well. I needed to get sober. And through sharing, I realized that I did have a gift for writing. I've always been a writer since I was a child, but I realized that I am able to take pretty big concepts that tend to be filled with shame, recovery, addiction, etc. But to talk about it in a very transparent and honest way and to also remove the shame from it, I took personal responsibility and accountability publicly out loud, and I built a community from that. So my work was, it was pretty much... It grew so quickly. My public profile grew very quickly here in the UK. And the term advocate, activist was put on me quite quickly. And again, I was okay with that because it felt good to have my work being taken quite seriously. But something that then started to happen from 2017 onwards, a year into my recovery, I started to be connected with various activist groups. So, you know, the idea of intersectionality was sort of becoming more public. The idea that if you're advocating for something here, there are also intersections. So if I'm advocating for recovery, it's also important for me to look at recovery through the lens of a Black person, right? So the racial aspect of recovery. Or what does recovery look like for someone that is disabled? What does recovery look like for someone who is an immigrant and doesn't have access to certain resources? But again, it was a very beautiful thing because it was expanding my own mind, my knowledge, but also expanding my community. But I could see that once the label activist was placed onto me, it became more restrictive. It became a thing where I felt as though, and this was not anyone else's doing, it was just the environment that we had all created, right? Because we want to stand for progress and we want to push against bigotry or whatever the thing is, oppression, et cetera, et cetera. But then it was interesting because I started to notice just how difficult it was to ask simple questions, to say, okay, and I think this is something you and I spoke about in our previous conversation, especially when it came to the topic of race. I did not feel comfortable from day one. I did not feel comfortable looking at and experiencing everything through the lens of race because that was not aligned to how I grew up. That was not aligned with just my own values and the way that I see the world. Of course, I can see the fact that I'm Black and I can see someone else's skin color, but I don't see that as a way to filter whether or not I'm going to interact with them. I don't see it as a means of deciding whether what they're saying is worthy or not. I've just never viewed the world in that way. But again, especially with the idea of intersectionalism as I was experiencing it at this time and told that it needs to be, that I do need to see things through the lens of race because the world is built on power dynamics. So if someone is more white, they have more power than I do. So again, these were things that maybe could have made sense in a university classroom where you're exploring academic ideas and jargon. But in the world that I navigated every single day, it didn't make sense that by default, I have to assume that a white person immediately is a person of privilege in the world that we live in. But what if I have been way more privileged than they are? What if I've grown up with so much financial ease? What if I have both parents? What if I, there were just so many things that didn't really make sense with some of the ideas that were being brought forward. But again, I didn't realize at the time, but the self-centering had really started then. It didn't seem like it was big enough to bring to the table and start asking these questions. In fact, it felt like it would be regressive. And I know that doesn't really sort of make sense, but it felt like to bring up questions that are uncomfortable and that could be contradictory would be a step back. So why mention anything anyway? Let me just keep this to myself. It's not a big deal. Mm. Let me just kind of continue doing what it is we need to do. And then once you do that once, I promise you, you will do it again and again and again. Have you ever experienced that? Just to jump in and ask you a question, kind of knowing that there's some little niggling in your mind and something that doesn't quite make sense, but it just feels like I better keep this one to myself because that's,
yeah,
right?
100%. I mean, everything you're saying, I think for most people, I would have a hard time believing that no one has not experienced that, because
yes.
I really like how you frame this idea that actually the questioning is perceived as a regression as opposed to a progression, like the criticism of it or the feedback to the system is actually the progress of the system, which shows you that diversity of thought actually makes thoughts better, right? Like without the feedback, you don't have the process of making ideas more inclusive, which is ironic, you know. And intersectionality is fascinating because it was like a theory that lived in the academic spaces that was not tested. It was just applied. And then there was no questioning of it. And, you know, you and I were talking before we hit record about just like, I never saw things through the lens of race. And then through all the conversations about race, I started to see things through the lens of race, which I think is one valuable, because then you have more context to people's experience that I wouldn't have thought about. And of course, that's sort of the premise of white privilege, is like, of course you don't have a lens because you've not experienced being in a, let's say, a black body or something.
Right.
So that I found really valuable. And then I was listening to Coleman Hughes in an interview that he did where, and for those of you listening, he's a black man, and he's, he was really saying like, I don't want to raise my kids in a world where they just think about like their race, that they are black. And obviously I'm minimizing the true depth of his conversation. Yeah. But one thing he said is like, what you're saying is like, well, what happens if, Like if we just say that race is the thing and all white people are privileged, then now we leave behind poor white people. Like they don't get targeted by social programs. And he said, but if we actually target socioeconomic issues, which are really the predictive things of poor outcomes, mental health, everything, he said, then we will disproportionately impact people of color, but we won't leave white people behind. And I thought, man, if you were to have this conversation, like, 2 years ago, canceled, maybe as a black person, not as much, but as a white person, for sure.
Oh my gosh.
There's this really interesting class on YouTube. It's the live, I wish I could remember it, but I believe it's from UPenn or Penn State. And this professor, actually, he live streams the class and then puts them up and then he takes short clips. But what he actually does is he has all these very diverse kids who obviously come from privilege for the most part, because they're all going to this expensive school. And he has them actually discuss these things where, like, let's say a student of color talks about privilege and how white people are just more privileged. And then he has someone who grew up poor as a white person, and they talk about, let's say, their childhood. And he's like, would you trade places with Tom? And they're like, probably not. And so it's what I love is that he takes these very complex statements and blanket statements we make, and he just shows that there is sometimes absurdity. There is sometimes, and I think it's this like this desire to want to organize the world in a way that makes it easy to navigate, right? Like we call them decision heuristics. Like we'll just like, I'll do what everyone else is doing because then I don't threaten group membership. I like,
yes.
So yeah, for sure. Like I held back my voice early on COVID, I started to interview doctors who were very, because I was curious about it. I had no thought right. on it. I didn't have I'm not anti-vax. I didn't have any of those thoughts. Mm-hmm. But it was actually when I saw them promoting it in pregnant women that, you know, one of the principles of medicine is the precautionary principle. I worked in pharma for 14 years. So I was like, mm-hmm. You know, I can read clinical trials. I do have yes. a qualification to understand how a drug's marketed. I would say I'm somewhat of an expert in that space because mm-hmm. I did it for so long. I launched drugs. But it was when I said, this doesn't make sense to me. Like, there's not the data to support this, like, blanket statement. And while they can promote it, they're just like, tell the truth of the complexity of the promotion. That's it.
Yes.
Just inform people. Oh, my God. I got, like, hundreds of replies that were like, this is dangerous, this. And then I also got, like, hundreds of replies from people being like, thank you for saying this. And I found myself constantly negotiating the editing of that desire to want to point to things that didn't make sense, but then also experiencing being shadow banned, getting tons of hate, getting called names. And I think one of the interesting responses to diverse thought, and I'm curious your thoughts on this, is like, words are violence, or like words are dangerous, or the statement yes. you're making is dangerous, and the impact that you see that has on people.
That, and I just had chills as you were speaking, because I feel like just in you sharing your story of that time, it truly reminds me of where I was as well at that time, because as I finished off saying, I found myself in those environments where essentially no questions were allowed. There was the appearance that you can ask questions, right? Because we're saying that we're for progress. We're saying that we want to encourage difficult conversations, people calling out their biases, et cetera. So there's the sort of presentation of an environment where uncomfortable conversations can happen. So you assume that there's critical thinking. You assume that there are questions. You assume that ideas get turned around and challenged and looked at from every angle to see whether they're valuable or not, you know. But that wasn't the case. That was not the case at all. It was a very single story. There was a set of things that are pre-approved. And terms, for example, which I think of more of as mantras, silence is violence, was absolutely one of those.
Yeah.
100%. So that's a way of thinking that I bought into without even realizing that I had bought into it from 2017 up until 2019. I had become so intolerant to anyone who asked questions, anyone that pointed out inaccuracies, or anyone that was just curious about why do I actually believe, why, how have I come to this belief and conclusion? Because I didn't fucking know. It was very threatening when someone asked me. When I wrote my open letter, I wrote something along the lines of, I was always one question away from my entire worldview crumbling. Because I was in echo chambers where no one asked questions. So when I was out there in the wild, whether it's with my family or friends or colleagues or people that I'm just meeting and talking to, I was always one question away from everything falling apart. So I had to be defensive because I couldn't defend my own ideas. So I had bought the idea of silence is violence. Or this very religious way of thinking, which I didn't actually agree with, but tried to make myself understand that white people are essentially born racist. And until they go on the journey of anti-racism, and you must have seen this in full force in 2020, right? On the journey of anti-racism, which includes buying one of the three books or some kind of course or whatever it
might
be.
I took a course. Of course you did. And I read White Fragility, I think.
Yes,
is that one
probably.
Of the top three?
That's one of the top three. Mm-hmm.
It's a great book.
The trifecta.
So I can still remember where I was walking when I was listening to it. That's funny.
But it's this thing, right? And I laugh about it because I think humor is
like
important.
So
you can really see the absurdity of all of it, because there was something very religious about it. That idea that as a white person, and to me, it's actually a really racist idea. But as a white person, you are born racist. You are born a white supremacist. And you have to, once you have the awareness of your existence in the world as a white person, you have to go on a journey of anti-racism and you get trained to be a proper person for society. It's actually a very sinister and disturbing thing, which I have never agreed with. And I'm okay with being very loud about that. I think it's incredibly dehumanizing. I think it doesn't take into account the context, the historical context of people's lives. You know, a white person in North America, you know, and a white person in Norway and Kenya and South Africa, are we flattening everyone's experience and sort of pretending that we know the intricacies of their life and their moral compass and their values and how they treat people, and sort of just placing this academic filter onto people? It's just insane, you know?
Yeah, it is.
So I think when it comes to race, that's where I just couldn't play whatever the game was. I just couldn't do it anymore in 2020. I participated in it for a while, for a couple of weeks specifically, when George Floyd was murdered, and many incredible and necessary conversations were started because of that very, very unfortunate 100%. And cruel death. And there was a very extreme and shadowy aspect to it. Something really psychologically disturbing happened in that timeline. And I don't think we'll truly understand the relationships that were fractured, the accusations that were made, you know, people being invited, if you're a black person or a so-called person of color, because I disagree with that term, that's why I say so-called, that you're supposed to sort of look back at your history and interaction with all white people, even some of the people closest to you, even your partners, your teachers, your lovers, your friends, and scan for malicious intent, and then go to them and ask them about that time, and look at it through the lens of race. Oh, it was sick. It was sick in my eyes. And that's when the veneer cracked for me in that time. It really did. And it made me think about all of those questions and thoughts that I had been suppressing in 2019, in 2018, in 2017. I remember I would do panels because eventually through my sobriety, I realized that I had so much sexual shame. So I started talking about removing sexual shame from women's pleasure. And again, the label feminist was placed onto me. I never said that I was, but now I'm a sobriety advocate and a feminist, you know.
Got a lot of, you're but collecting the titles.
I'm collecting them like belts, you know. But but then again, what happens then? And I didn't have an issue with it. It never felt quite right, because culturally where I'm from, there are just certain terms that we might live by, but we don't wear them as identity pieces. You know, if you look at my values, they absolutely align with feminism, as in the progressive feminism, not whatever regressive thing we have currently that we call feminism. So I was okay with that. But I remember, Mark, that I would do, and this was around 2017, 18, when I'd be on panels and I'd be talking about women's pleasure. And then I would have people saying to me that I should say women and femmes, because it's leaving out trans women. And because I've been connected to the LGBTQ community for most of my life, they were some of the people that really helped me kind of find my sense of self and identity being a young person here in London, you know. So it's a community that I hold so much love and fondness and reverence for. But I started to notice just, again, the policing and language. And because I wanted to make sure that I'm being inclusive, I was like, yeah, of course. So it's women and femmes. And then the next moment, if I'm writing it online, you have people saying, instead of writing the word woman, you should put an X on the E, because that includes all types of women, not just cis women. And I didn't understand, what does cis women mean,
right?
You know? So again, I had the willingness to be so-called educated and to do the right thing and to modify my language. But guess what? It's never enough. It's never enough, because the moment that you change one thing, someone comes in and you have to change another. And I was okay with it. But then once you modify one thing, this is what I found. you end up modifying so much, and not just externally, not just when I'm actually on stage at a talk or when I'm online sharing an idea. It started to happen in my mind. When I would be sharing my own subjective story as a woman, I would think, in sharing my story, am I excluding trans women or non-binary women? Or so it sort of started there, but I never could have really realized that if 2020 didn't happen and that veneer hadn't cracked, and then I had to actually think, wait, this feels historical. It doesn't feel like it's just something that's happening in this moment in time because of race. And then I realized, shit, I've actually been self-censoring for much longer than I've realized. That's when everything started to unravel. And it wasn't sudden in any way. I think the summer of BLM was one thing. But then exactly as you were saying, shortly after that, that's when it moves, you know. Now it's the vaccines. Now you have to pick if you're pro or anti. You can't just be someone who's like, you know what, I want to wait because I think this is the best thing to do for myself or for my family. Mm-hmm. I don't know enough about this, so I can't make a decision around this. Or I'm already very unwell. I don't trust taking something else that I don't know just yet, you know. Or these people are being injured, people that were very, very healthy and fine just a week ago, and they thought they were doing the right thing, but now they're injured. Let's have that conversation. I shared a few things, a few videos of people that were injured very badly. And I saw what happens, or the so-called price there is to pay for asking questions.
Yeah.
Suddenly there were people in my audience who were very disappointed in me. How can I be sharing so many harmful things, misinformation, even though it's an actual video of someone who is injured and they thought they were doing the right thing. And now suddenly that person is an anti-vaxxer. So everything just started to unravel from, I would say, May 2020. And then for me, there was no turning back. I was willing to accept whatever so-called social punishment there would be so that I could free myself and ask questions. That's all.
Yeah, not oppose everything, be against everything, but literally be curious. It's interesting how cultures and groups of humans create norms. And I would say those norms in the context of, in the subjects we're talking about, Black Lives Matter, vaccines, gender is a big one too. The media and politicians dictate the sort of temperature of the dialogue and then create policies around that. And then what happens is you see, then that leaks into culture and you know, where someone might have a debate. What happened during COVID is, even if someone was so credentialed from Stanford or Harvard or wherever, if they didn't agree with the main held narrative, what would be said, and this happened, and I'm curious your experience of this, what would be said is, we don't want a platform these people. We don't want to give space to their voices. Like the conversation is happening about climate too, the same sort of structure of, well, we don't want to talk to someone who's critical about the climate change idea or has a differing view based on different models that are being used. And it's like, we don't want to give them a platform because they're misinformation, disinformation. What I started to see during COVID was this, like, actually, that's disinformation. Like, the promoted information was disinformation infers malice. It's hard for me not to think there was some recognition of the cost of the misrepresentation of marketing that occurred. Like, all of a sudden people were like, they never said it stopped transmission. I'm like, there's literally hundreds of videos. So now you have to deny reality. But really what's happened is your fear has just, like, attached to something else. And so I saw the same shaping of conversation where I thought, well, this is really interesting that we're, like, just having a conversation that the left, if it was 4 years ago, actually, if it was pre-COVID and you said, hey, I'm questioning taking this blood pressure pill, you would be seen as educated. You'd be seen as like, oh, the right wants pharma to make money, you know? And now it's like so fascinating to see that what is calling itself the left is pro-pharma, is pro-censorship, is pro-war, and I know that's a complex statement, but yeah. I just mean like that was not traditionally what the left stood for. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, depending on your perspectives of different wars, that's going to be like standing for freedom or not. It's interesting to see that we seem to want to stay in this. Like, do you see that is there like a comfortable box we want to sit in? Like that if we open to curiosity, like what do you see? Is it that our fake or very fragile world, fake is maybe not fair, but like very fragile worldview rests on silencing any criticism? Like, is that it?
Yeah, I ask myself this all the time, Mark, and I think that's one part of it. But something that I've been thinking about is sometimes we think, I think it's something to do with what we call cancel culture, right? This association thing. That if I am associated with this person or with this idea or with this opinion, or I even look like I slightly agree with it or even understand it, then I am also going to be punished, that I am also going to be exiled. I think that's a part of it as well. And that's the part that I definitely experienced, even when it came to people, you know, in our previous conversation, or maybe it hadn't happened yet. I remember I had had a conversation with Jordan Peterson.
No, you hadn't happened yet. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That conversation, which happened in 2021, is a conversation that I never, ever would have said yes to before. But not even that. It's a conversation that I would have never imagined happening, because he's someone that I was told is a representation of evil, full stop. He is not someone to listen to. He has nothing. And when I say nothing, I mean nothing. Nothing valuable to add, nothing valuable to say. All he knows is how to be evil and to be a bigot, full stop. And I'd really bought into that story without even, and I want you to pay attention to, listener, to how your body felt when I said that name, because that can be useful information. Maybe it was quite neutral. Maybe you felt like, oh, they're talking about this person that I listen to and kind of like, or maybe you've immediately decided to disregard anything that I've said now because I mentioned Jordan Peterson's name and I said that I've had a conversation with him. Just play the role of the observer, because he's someone who I think represents so much to people. So much meaning is placed onto this person in Western society, you know. And mm-hmm. for me, I'd never engaged with anything he'd put out in the world. Only a small little clip where he was in an interview with Kathy Newman and they were talking about the gender pay gap, but I'd already been primed to have a specific reaction to him. So when I started to do my own unraveling in 2020 and really started to think about who were some of the people that I had, disposed of without even asking any questions. He was one of those people. And I spoke about it publicly to my audience, and his daughter got in touch, and him and I ended up having the conversation. But I say that to say the reason that at the time where, you know, I embodied this idea that he was a bigot, he's evil, etc., is because someone who was in my tribe had told me. And so by virtue of it being someone who's in my tribe, the left, a person of color, I was to just trust them and believe it immediately. Me going on some kind of search to be like, oh, is that actually true? Let me listen to a lecture or something like that. It would have felt like I'm rejecting this person and associating with him. Mm. And that is exactly what I would experience quite often. And I think it's what a lot of people experience, the idea that even if I'm remotely curious about this person and this opinion, even if I start thinking, wait, could the right have a point on this thing? And I'm a left-leaning person. Ooh. Sometimes it's the danger of the association that I will be seen as one of them. And by being seen as one of them, I will be rejected by my community. I'll be exiled. I'll be shamed. So it's this cancellation by proximity. I think that's one of the biggest things for sure. For sure.
That's so interesting to think of, like, in some way, asking the question or even entering the space of curiosity, like,
yeah,
hey, this might not be true, which I've seen people now come out of COVID being like, oh, like a lot of that actually didn't make sense. And I think when you look at the public adoption of the booster, you see how people truly feel. It's also the majority of people in the United States moved from liberal Democratic states to Republican states, which you know, tells you that people actually vote for policies they want with their footsteps. And you know, I think the idea that entering a behavior that now is not seen as normal, where all of a sudden you're like breaking the rules of the group. And so you almost feel like you're, what is the right word? It's like you're like betraying, the ideology and the concepts. And I mean, I think you see a lot of people negotiating with that. Like your book, why I think it's so aptly timed, is like, I'm telling you, 94% of the conversations I'm having with people are that they feel a certain way about something, but they would never publicly state that. I especially see that in the world of psychology with psychologists or mental health experts, where they had like a perspective on the gender conversation that they're not public about because they don't want to get canceled. And I'm like, but your perspective is the one that's actually necessary. And like, by not speaking, you are consenting to this. Like, and again, like, even when I say they have feelings about the gender conversation, it's that they just, it's not just all affirmative. Like, they're actually part of really good relating, being in love with someone, being a friend with someone, being a parent, being an interventionist of any type, is to be with truth.
Yes. Like, yes.
The truth and reality. And like a really good parent doesn't try to protect their kid from reality. They're actually, their job is to mirror it, which is to, so that a person can start to discern fantasy from truth. And and not to say fantasy's bad or hope's bad or possibility's bad or dreaming's bad, but it's like, when does that, like, if all of a sudden I have to participate in that, like, what was a controversial story I put up was, I said, I just find it like, I think it was the American or Canadian Anthropological Association canceled a session that was on something about biological sex and the importance of anthropological blah, blah, blah. And they canceled it because of all the pushback. And basically what I said in my Instagram story was like, it's crazy to me that it is controversial to say that biological sex is a real thing. Like the idea that that even activates fear in me, that I'm saying this, and then now, and of course I got replies saying I'm transphobic, but, or I'm like, I want harm. And it's like, no, my God, no. Like, I can love someone's expression and want safety for them. And also be like, hey, biological sex is real. Like, those can coexist. And anyways, it can, led me to having this conversation about how, like, there are some people who believe they're animals, and then our job is to reflect that they are actually a bird. Like, no.
I think this is so important, even just exploring this out loud without having some kind of neat conclusion or wrapping it in so many disclaimers and caveats and whatever.
Right.
I think this is good because we're no longer speaking like normal people. We're speaking like Twitter threads. We're speaking like infographics. We're speaking like, and it's pretty fucking insane. We get to speak like normal people, you know, and we get to explore things out loud and to be curious and to make mistakes and to wonder whether it was a mistake or it wasn't, or to just say what it is we need to say. Because it's exactly that thing of constantly walking on eggshells and just hoping that you don't offend anyone, you know, or offend what I call the mob in your own mind. I think it's a really, really, we can't not look at this. We can't not look at this. And I don't think any of what we're talking about, Mark, is a nice to have in terms of advocating for brave expression and courage and asking questions and being okay with changing our minds and being okay with challenging each other and being okay with acknowledging objective truth and being okay with acknowledging subjective experiences without thinking that we need to speak for everyone. I think it's really making I think a lot of us are becoming cowards in relationship and in conversation. And I wonder what you think from the perspective of sort of relational intimacy as a collective, because I think a lot of this is anti-intimacy. How can we be intimate with each other if we can't challenge each other? How can we be intimate if we can't say, actually, I'm not the same person that you thought I was, whether that's to your audience or to your family or to a partner or to an individual? I just think a lot of this is pulling us further and further and further apart and just putting us in a even deeper place of individualism, which is already a big problem in the Western world. But I think I wanted to speak with you because of that anti-intimacy thing, because it's something that I seem to be thinking about more and more, that this is just, how can we love and connect in this environment? I don't know that we can, because even on dating apps, you see things like, so the Conservative Party here are called the Tories, right? They're called the Tories. So you see that on dating apps all over, it's like no Tories, no bigots, no transphobes, no whatever. And it's like, sure, I get it. But it's like we're so label and identity driven. How can we connect? We can't.
It feels so toxic. The behavior itself is so, it's so intolerant, and it masquerades under the umbrella of tolerance. That's the whole irony, is it's like when someone gets to that stage, which I understand why someone doesn't want to hang out with a bigot, but like not every conservative.
But it's also common sense. It's also condescending because it's like, no one wants to, no serial killers. Yeah, we know.
Well, I think the irony too is like it's almost like I'm flagging like how virtuous I actually am, and I'm quickly sorting through the dating process, but it's also like I'm actually just showing how inflexible my mind is. I'm showing how intolerant I am. To me, that shit's a red flag now. Like, I'm like, oh my God. I had a friend whose parent I was talking to, and the parent said, oh, like you spend some time in Idaho. And I said, yeah, we go there sometimes in the summer. And she said, isn't that just filled with Trumpers? And I was like, I mean, yeah, but like a lot of people from California and Washington moved there during COVID. And she's like, so like you hang out with, I'm like, I actually have no idea who anyone votes for, who I hang out with. And I actually have no idea their vax status because I don't give a shit. Like, why would I all of a sudden put them in a box that then I can't now have dinner with someone who I might disagree with, who I might learn from? Like, we had such a, now this person is from California, would identify as quite left. And I get that. But I also was like, wow, I would miss out on so many connections. And I think like when we stopped inviting people to dinner within our own families, and stop breaking bread with people who we disagree with. We stopped, like when we don't want to be around them, it's because we don't want to experience the discomfort of our own fallacies, our own fragility, right? You know, and the fragility of our ideas. And if your ideas require censorship, then your ideas are not good ideas. They're only based on the premise of silencing people and using shame as a mechanism. And I think when, for example, COVID came along and they said, if you're vaccinated, we're all in this together, all this language inferred belonging. And if you're not, then you're a bad person and you don't have other people's backs. What happens there is you now naturally humans, I would say, desire good. They desire to help. They desire progress. But if progress is appealed to in order to engage in a behavior change, but it actually requires dehumanizing and moving a group of people in your life, your friends, your family, where they can't come to Christmas anymore. And I think like my whole problem with that was like, it wasn't logical because the vaccine didn't stop transmission. So the logical thing would have been, and this is, you know, 2021 fall when we had our conversation, was really the height of this. But it was widely known that it didn't stop transmission. It was never proven in clinical trials. That's a whole other can of worms. But it was like, if you're not inviting someone, the rational perspective would have been get everyone tested, you know, and then if you test positive or negative, you come or you don't come. That would have been the fair, rational, non-emotional response. But through tribalism, we didn't do that. And I think intimacy, how do you have intimacy when you can't have the safety for difference?
Like, yeah.
Isn't true intimacy the experience of being witnessed even in the things you might be most ashamed of, and maybe most especially? And it's like, do we create a culture that then like trickles down into our interpersonal relationships, as you're saying, on dating apps? But like, people broke up because of these types of conversations. Uh-huh. People, and it's like, wait, the other day I was doing a somatic therapy session, and one of the things I had deep in like my gut was, when I had to put words to it, was like, they weaponized my friends and family. Yes. Like, and I think about that on social media of like, there has been a willingness, whether it's malicious or not, it doesn't matter. But the consequence is that and it doesn't matter if you're pro or anti. Everybody is a victim of the weaponization of psychological techniques to try to get assimilation. So like, the person canceling someone is also a victim, because they become the type of person who cancels someone.
Yes.
Which is inherently, you are unconsciously saying you agree with that type of behavior, which means you're also unconsciously saying it might come for me one day. Gosh. What do you think?
Oh, 100%. The fear that underpins all of this is just, this is why I have to make sure that even when I have these conversations with my audience or with people, that I remember how easy it was at points for me to get captured by this, because I had so many ideas about who I was as a person, that I'm open-minded, I'm autonomous, I'm a sovereign being, and I could think for myself, that it really was a shock to the system when I realized just what I was participating in on a small scale or a larger scale, whatever it was, whatever part of the scale I was on. It really was a shock to the system, because it just showed me that sometimes you might think you know so much about yourself and how you will behave in a situation, but you have to be in it to find out, and you have to see it to even know you're in it, right? Because I think one of the things is that I wanted to make sure that even when I broke out of that trance and really realized what was happening around me and within me, that I didn't go into a space of self-righteousness, because I saw how easy that can be to happen. You see it when people go from so-called woke and right fall so neatly into being anti-woke, and suddenly now everyone is a sheep and they're a free thinker, et cetera, whatever it might be. And they end up behaving in exactly the same way, the way that they claim. It's the thing that I write about in here, that and the words that I put forward, is that I was saying that I was pushing back against intolerance, but I was taking the most extreme and intolerant measures to get there. You know, that idea of becoming the very thing that you claim to oppose, which I think is exactly what we're talking about, you know, where you become the one that's dehumanizing, but you're saying you're standing up against dehumanization. So I could see just how easy it can be to become so self-righteous with whatever your newfound insights and knowledge is. So I think it's why I actually don't use the language of woke as much. So you might notice that it's something that I used in the open letter, why I'm leaving the cult of wokeness, because I think wokeness is a very specific thing. To me, it's like an infection of sorts. It's like woke was at one point in time a good thing, and then it sort of morphed and it was hijacked by bad faith actors, and it's become this thing called wokeness, you know. But I make sure that even in my language, I'm not dehumanizing people. So I never use the language of woke. I never use sheep in reference to other people. I never say things like the woke or whatever, because I also think it's useless.
Same.
It's feeding that very same division. It just is, you know, and I think it's so tempting and seductive to end up doing it. But I do my very best. It's why I don't even call, I use the term cancel culture if it's specific in the context, but it's why I created the term collective sabotage, because it doesn't have that same charge and it doesn't take a side. And I think it's actually more accurate, to describe what is happening around us when our behavior is in direct conflict with what we say it is we want, you know? And I think it's because of self-sabotage. It's each individual in their mode of self-sabotage. And then we come together as a collective and it becomes what we see as cancel culture. To me, that's collective sabotage. So I'm very intentional with my language. And this might be useful for anyone listening to this to just think, where are you finding yourself using, even without even realizing, especially without realizing, dehumanizing language that feeds into the very division that you probably want to push back against? So I don't know if that answers your question or feeds back into what you were talking about previously, but it's just something that came to mind around how when you suddenly are awake to something, I see this happen all the time, it can be very easy to fall very neatly into the very same thing. Just it's kind of slightly shifted and the different name for it, you know. That's why I think the far left and the far right in very different ways, because I think the far right has far more kind of really seriously impactful, they're more powerful, I would say, globally.
Yeah,
whereas I think the far left, when it comes to certain behaviors, though, and characteristics and ways of going about things, they're the same. To me, the woke and anti-woke end up behaving in exactly the same way. They're both for cancel culture, but it just depends on who's getting canceled, you know. You see it all the time.
That's really interesting. The idea of the sabotage, like I want to hear more about that because what you said, how when you recognize that you've been captured by an idea and then all of a sudden you're like, I hate wokeness and I'm going to do that. And you're right. You do participate in the same division because you're now like putting another label on another side and another thing. And you're just moving in the trauma triangle. So again, you're like, now you're not the victim. You're the savior and there's always a perpetrator. And you just move back and forth between victim and savior, but you're never the perpetrator, God forbid.
Right.
How do you see that level of like, it's almost like a trauma bond. How do you see that occur in like what is self-sabotage that moves into collective self-sabotage? What is sort of the process of that?
The reason why to me I always bring back to the self is, well, to me that's where my work and exploration even started, because I saw my own self-sabotaging patterns and behavior in recovery, in trying to get sober, in relapsing 7 times, in finding so much discomfort actually in getting well, which is why I relapsed so many times. It's not because I was missing alcohol. It's actually not even about the alcohol. It was because there was so much discomfort in things actually going well for me. It was uncomfortable to see a version of Africa that was actually reliable, that followed through with what she said she would do, that didn't cheat in relationships, that didn't cause so much chaos and destruction around her. It was more familiar to be in that pattern where there'll be something that I need to apologize for tomorrow morning, but I have no idea what it's going to be. There was some kind of thrill almost. Before we started recording, we were speaking about something and we spoke about the thrill, just the thrill in destruction and causing chaos, you know, and it's familiar, you know it. It's rewarding in some way. So I would sabotage myself so much when I was so close to attaining a certain amount of time. Then I would pull the plug on myself and go back to what it is that I knew. So in getting sober for the 8th time when I was 24, nearly 9 years ago now, that's when I discovered the term self-sabotage. When your behavior is in direct conflict with what you say it is you want. When there's a discomfort in things actually going well. You know, you feel like the shoe might drop at any point. So let me just get in there and take the shoe off myself, you know, because it's better if I do it that way. So by the time 2019, 2020, all the things that we spoke about, by the time they came around, I'd already been studying and researching and really wanting to understand the mechanics of self-sabotage. Why do we go into these destructive patterns and cycles? And we become just very loud contradictions of ourselves, but we also don't want to own any of those contradictions. So they become shadows. That's when I started to notice it within the collective to be like, oh, fuck, that's exactly what's happening in these activist groups that I'm a part of. Again, there's this presentation that we're open-minded and that we're curious and that we practice critical thinking and that we're for accountability and that we're for collectivism. But actually, the truth of it is that we're the complete opposite of those things. Maybe there are one or two people that are actually in alignment with what they're saying, but the majority of us are incredibly intolerant and we're sabotaging ourselves and we can't even see it. So that's when I sort of saw collective sabotage very close to home. And then by the time 2020 comes around and we're all online confined in our homes, I just saw it in a way that was so extreme. So again, the term cancel culture, which can encompass public shaming, doxing, social exile, intolerant of opposing views, whatever the thing might be, you know, reputation destruction. It can be just so many different things that we sort of lump into this thing called cancel culture. But we have a definition problem because if you ask someone else, they'll tell you, no, it's just accountability. So we're working with very different definitions and never getting anywhere. But to me, collective sabotage was such an accurate, even the visual of it to me was so much more accurate. And it made sense because then when you bring it back to the individual, when you bring it back to the self, it shows you that if you're able to change something within yourself and we come together as a collective, then we're actually more likely to see some kind of shift, you know? So it sort of came from that place.
So in the face of all of this, right, the potential exile, the potential public shaming, the potential, like I think about somatically the nervous system's capacity to hold all of these possible consequences. And before we were talking earlier about how like when one person in that study speaks up, the other person is more likely to speak up and oppose the group.
Yes.
How do we begin? Like maybe we're the first person in our, let's say, friend group or community, you know, we could write an essay or a letter, an open letter like you did and just kind of blow it up. Like, this is my coming out, you know, story.
Yeah.
Like I'm tired of holding all these things, which I see happen relationally a lot. Like I'm just tired of pretending everything's okay or sweeping things under the rug and like I'm gone or I'm whatever it is. So how do we begin or continue to bravely express in this face of intolerance?
Yeah, you know what? There's no one answer for this, but the way that I like to think about it, because it can feel so big, you know why? Because it is in a lot of ways, right? Especially depending on how much you also struggle with self-censorship, it really can be a lifelong practice. But I like to think of it as you have so much opportunity in those micro daily interactions, you know. I think of it as in those micro moments where you're around a dinner table or you're with just one person and there's an instance where you would go into fawning and agreeing with something you don't actually agree with just to please the other person. And we have so many labels on ourselves about this kind of behavior, right? People pleasing. And I find it so interesting the way sort of people just drop it into conversation. Oh, I'm such a people pleaser, you know. People sort of own that label. So if you are someone that tends to label themselves that, I think one of the first things you could do is to remove that label from yourself, because I think there's a lot of labeling that we do, which then reinforces that behavior of agreeing with things that you don't actually agree with. But I would say if this feels big, which it is, but I break all of this down in the book, which is why I think it's important for you to get it, because there's so many questions and reflections and it's so practical because it's supposed to be a roadmap for you. But something that I emphasize is those micro interactions where if you were to agree, say, let's go into scripting a little bit and maybe Mark, you can also share some of your own that come up. But something that I find so useful that people don't do enough is to say, I don't know, you know, and there's a way in which you can say, I don't know. You're around, again, that scene that I was painting out, you're around a dinner table with friends and there's a conversation that's happening. Let's say it was back in 2021 or it's something that comes up again and it's around vaccines. People are asking, oh, so are you pro or anti? Are you going to get the booster or whatever it might be? And it comes around to you. You can actually say, you know what? I'm not sure yet. And you can leave it as that, you know. If people press a little bit more and again, you feel that pressure to over-explain, which again is something that happens, you go into that mode of feeling like you need to give someone an answer. please remember, you actually don't owe anyone an answer in any moment. You could say, I just haven't made a decision about it, right? And even if it's something that's not as charged as that, all I'm saying is that we do need to be willing to take more emotional risks. I think sometimes we think that courage and bravery are just something, things that are going to be gifted to us because we want them. But you do have to take emotional risks. And the risk you're willing to take is going to be different from mine. It's going to be different from Mark's. You know the context of your life. You know the relationships that you have around you. But I do genuinely believe that we all have opportunities every single day in our interactions to have those moments, those micro moments of courage where if we were to agree before, we say, actually, I don't feel that way. Or I don't see things in that way. What do you think? Turn it back to the other person and not feel like you have to give something or that you have to give something to them by lying to yourself. So I think, again, there are many different things a person could do, and I'll take you through that in the book. But I do think you have to put yourself in the arena and take those little opportunities to build that muscle. Because I think we think it's going to happen in some big way, like the open letter, right? But that's not how it happens. Even that open letter, it didn't happen in isolation. Just from this conversation, you can see that it started happening from 2017 onwards when I started to notice that there was a bit of an issue. 2019, when I got a little bit braver and in my offline life, started to have conversations with friends to be like, have you noticed this thing? Or to just start asking questions in the people around you. I didn't go online first. Online happened so much later, but I had to build that muscle in my everyday conversations. Because again, if you have this idea that you're going to get one big moment to practice bravery and undo self-censorship, it doesn't happen in that way. You're presented with so many tiny, little, seemingly small, seemingly irrelevant opportunities every single day. And I think that compounds, that adds to something.
I think surrounding ourselves with people who are curious, who ask questions, who are challenging traditional ways of being. I think your book is a perfect way to either begin or continue the deepening of that. Like, because it is it's a skill set, you know, it's a skill set. It's also relationally, everybody desperately craves creating relationships where you're actually safe to disagree. You're psychologically safe to have a different experience. Mm-hmm. It's true anyways. So why not actually create the space for difference, for different experiences? This is how truly great relationships are created. And I always think, like, if we read your book and we start to, or continue to hold on to ourselves in relationship to other people's experience of who we are and what we're saying, and not collapse and people please and enter codependency. Mm. But the more we hold and build and create boundaries around a sense of self, that just transcends. Because if we respect our own ideas, or at least we have a sense of some of what we believe and what we value, and we really honor that, we will honor other people's.
And
so it's such a, what you're providing is really an invitation to a revolutionary act in a way, to what a cultural norm has said is like you being, it's ironic that it's like really overt collectivism, but there's like a narcissism hiding in this collective altruism.
Right.
It's really a strange, it's like vulnerable narcissism, you know, and it's so easy to get trapped in that. And my invitation to people, one is go buy Africa's Brook. Go buy Africa's book. And the cost of censoring yourself and silencing yourself isn't just you feel like you don't get to say something. There is a somatic physiological cost. It increases inflammation. It causes mental health challenges. You're going to get anxiety, which will likely lead to depression. And from a self-responsibility perspective, just which is not negating people's experience of not feeling safe to express themselves. But the more we silence ourselves, we are actually consenting to co-creating those types of relationships. Mm-hmm. And is that the legacy we want to leave for the families we create, the systems we're part of? I would rather hang around with a bunch of black sheep, with a bunch of people who,
absolutely,
you know, it's I might not agree with them, but walking alongside people who are challenging your thoughts and thoughts in general, the world is made better, Africa. Your work is so profound. And I'm so happy that I found your work amidst COVID, you know, and I just found so much solace in your words, just like, like someone actually putting into language what has been my experience that I couldn't label. Yes. And like, why am I so scared to say this? And you really have continued to inspire courage in me to, you know, one of my favorite quotes of your, one recent your quotes is to live as if you're already canceled. And yes. I love that because it's like, what's possible if you already lose everything?
Right. Everything. Right. Oh, I love that you say that. And thank you so much. And the last thing you said too really stood out to me around the community piece. Creating a community, even if you feel like you have no one in your life right now that challenges you, someone that you can challenge, someone you can riff out loud with and, you know, put your so-called wrong thoughts forward to, someone you can share dark jokes with and you can sort of, I think that's important. And the good thing about having, being in a time where technology is globalized in the way that it is, it's actually never been easier to find community that is so specific. There's a problem with that in that you can find yourself in echo chambers. However, if you're very intentional about creating community, finding community, you can absolutely do it. Even engaging in conversations like this, if you're like, Africa, I don't agree with this so much. Mark, I don't agree with this so much. But you find yourself still appreciating how open we are, how curious we are. That already shows you that there's something within you that is so important and needs to be nurtured, because that curiosity, it really is dying. It really is dying. We're made to believe that we're not allowed to have it, or you're allowed to have it behind closed doors, you know. And I think that's a big problem, because that means you can't be curious creatively, politically, in the workplace, in just so many arenas in life. So I think the community piece is really important. And in the book, actually, I write something or even give very specific steps and prompts around cultivating what I call the maverick mindset, where you can actually learn to become an independent thinker, or making sure that if you are someone who identifies as an independent thinker, you're not actually maybe in self-righteousness. Maybe you need to refine your social filter more. Maybe you need to have more empathy and compassion and openness and understanding. I really just want to make sure that we're working with ourselves, not working against ourselves. And I really hope that this book can do that. And this conversation has affirmed a lot of what my mission stands in. So thank you so, so much. Thank you.
I love your mission. And like, I feel like our missions are so aligned, because it's like, to me, love is telling the truth. Full stop. That's it. Like, there's actually no qualifiers to that. It's like, love is telling and being with the truth. And if you love somebody, you tell them the truth. That's it. And of course, truth is subjective. And it's objective, as you said earlier, like, can we be with both the subjectivity and the objectivity? Like, but not abandon objectivity that causes emotional dysregulation to subjectivity. And that is like, what a nuanced dance that is. But that is the beauty of the complexity of being human.
Yes.
And I'm going to have one thing in hindsight. I'm going to really, I just so appreciate how you formulate the way human systems and the mind works, and the way the complexity of our fears, but how we can stand in bravery and what standing in bravery stands for. But I'm also going to laugh that when you gave the standard white male response to Black Lives Matter, I checked all the boxes for taking the course, reading the book. So I'm like, I was laughing at that, thinking like, you read one of the three books and you took this course.
And you know, and just like, it had to be white fragility.
Totally. The bestseller. But I think like what it speaks to is like, and why I find it funny is like, we are all capable of being captured by things, of course, but also the beautiful intention of something, because my perspectives were broadened through that, but I could have easily got trapped into the role I was now supposed to play. And so there's such beauty in all ideological perspectives. And so there's good in the intention of them. It's just that when we fear challenging them, they then go unchallenged, and they actually can become, they can become dangerous in a lot of ways. And I agree with you that curiosity and courage are like starting to die. And it's like, hell no, that ain't happening, because no great civilization was created from either of those dying. So Africa, I love you. I appreciate you.
I love you.
Where can people get your book?
You can buy it from any bookseller. If you're in the US, North America, that would be Barnes & Noble, could be Amazon. Anywhere you find books, you can find it. And make sure you're supporting your independent booksellers as well. But you can find The Third Perspective everywhere on audiobook as well. I loved recording the audiobook, Mark. I didn't think I would love sitting there for 16 hours, but I loved every moment of it. And it can be heard in the audio, so you can go on a walk with me. But I'm very excited to just know what people think and how people experience this, because it's not a memoir. It's not an extended rant of anything that I've written before. It is something so unique and so specific to the reader. I wanted to feel I wanted it to feel like it's just me and the reader, and I'm taking them through very specific practices and questioning so they can create their own roadmap, not me giving them something, you know. So I'm so excited for you to have this.
Yeah, and as a new author, can I say how important it is that you buy the hardcover of Africa's book? And I've bought three copies because I'm going to gift a few. And bought the audiobook because that's how I usually consume info. So for you listening, like, buy a hard copy, support Africa. Let's help get her to the moon with her book. It needs to be out there. Africa, I appreciate you. All the links will be in the show notes. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.